It's Wednesday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, voters in Iowa help set the direction for U.S. presidential candidates.
In the last year, it's managed to jump across to Central and South America, right on the doorsteps of the United States.
Virus finds new breeding ground in the Americas. Also ahead, another North Korean missile is on the launch pad while we explore covering news from the Hermit Kingdom. And a new movie, just in time for Valentine's Day. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz emerged the winners of the Iowa caucuses, the first decision by voters in the long state-by-state primary process that leads to the Democrats and Republicans selecting their nominees for the general election in November. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone shared his thoughts on the outcome, including the second-place finish by outspoken billionaire Donald Trump, with International Edition host Susan Yockey.
I think the air of invincibility that we'd seen for months in polling data was a bit pierced here in Iowa with a win by Ted Cruz. He went the traditional path of counting on especially conservative Christian voters. Trump, you know, underperformed a little bit. And then there was the surprising finish, strong finish of Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, right on Trump's heels. And that's going to really shake up the race.
And it looks like Clinton got a little bit of a scare over in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, a scare in one sense. I think the Bernie Sanders supporters are looking at it as a victory. I mean, it was basically a virtual tie. And now they head to New Hampshire, where Senator Sanders, who's, of course, from neighboring Vermont, has been very strong for months in the polls. And so it's going to be an uphill fight for Hillary Clinton to win in New Hampshire. She'll probably try to get closer to him. I think what it all means is the close finish in Iowa for the two Democrats means that the Democratic primary race is going to go on for quite a while. It's going to be a hard-fought, close contest for a bit. But Clinton at least can claim a very marginal victory there, and that, you know, avoiding a defeat, which I think would have been really difficult.
And we also lost two possible nominees.
Yeah, we did. Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side, who didn't really register much in Iowa or New Hampshire, is suspending his campaign. And Mike Huckabee, who's had made a second bid for the White House after falling short in 2008, Huckabee's leaving the race. I think, you know, once we get past New Hampshire next week, you could see kind of a crowded rush at the door because some of these folks just aren't going to make the cut. New Hampshire will be all about, by the way, finding the establishment alternative to Trump and Cruz. And Rubio right now is perhaps the leading contender for that, but he's going to have a lot of competition in New Hampshire from people like Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich.
Well, I was a little surprised, and I felt sorry for Jeb Bush because he really didn't do well. He's, as you know, Jim, the brother of a former president and the son of a former president, and it doesn't. Do you think he's going to make it at all?
You know, my colleague Mike Burke and I were out with him campaigning over the weekend in central Iowa in a rural place, and he drew a small crowd. It was a nice exchange he had, but you didn't feel the passion. And if you go to some of the other events that we went to, a Ted Cruz rally, for example, there was quite a bit more intensity. And I think for whatever reason, this particular election cycle is not, you know, friendly to Jeb Bush. He doesn't appear to be the right fit for the kind of angry and, you know, aggressive Republican voters. They're looking for a different type of candidate.
Well, with this Trump not coming in first, do you think he knew that beforehand? Did you sense anything from his camp about the vote yesterday?
There was some low-key Trump that we haven't seen before. And he's getting some kudos for his sort of gracious, speech, acknowledging that he came in second. We'll see what happens in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a state that has been very favorable to him so far in the polls. I think the question is, what kind of a bounce does Rubio get heading up to New Hampshire now? And even Cruz. Cruz is not a great fit for New Hampshire because he's very conservative. But, you know, it's a very jumbled and kind of, you know, competitive Republican race right now. And I think a lot of different things could happen.
Well, turning now to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio for reactions to Monday's caucuses. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Let's hear from the winners and the losers.
Sure. I don't know which party's result was more interesting for you personally, but why don't we start with Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
So this is his reaction. My experience in Iowa was a great one. I started out with all the experts saying I couldn't do well there and ended up in the second place. Nice. More than 4,000 people share that tweet. And the following two tweets are a bit of explanation, if you will, as to why he couldn't win. He said that because he was told he couldn't do well in Iowa, he spent very little compared to Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. He also blamed the media, saying it hasn't covered his long-shot, quote-unquote, great finish in Iowa fairly.
And this is the same person who said he could shoot somebody and wouldn't lose voters.
Exactly, and that's what he said during his rally in Iowa. So it's not too easy to believe he thought winning there was a long shot. As for Ted Cruz, he sent out a brief tweet. He wrote, "Thank you, Iowa. This is our time. Join us at tedcruz.org. Less than 3,000 people retweeted that.
Fewer retweets than Trump, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a look at the Democratic side. What's Clinton saying?
You know what? I think Clinton is trying very hard to appear more personable, especially on social media platforms. When the results from a very close race with Bernie Sanders, as you saw, came out, she sent out this tweet. "From the bottom of my heart, thank you, Iowa H." Most of her tweets are sent by her campaign staffers, but the ones from her, like this one, are signed with her initial H.
Well, Bernie Sanders had a pretty good night, too, didn't he?
I think so. Like Jim Malone said, it was a virtual tie. Sanders tweeted this, "We accomplished what the political establishment said was impossible. Don't underestimate us." And I think that's a very poignant point because many people are questioning whether his relatively newfound popularity is sustainable. That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, thanks for the update, G, and you can follow both of us on Twitter, first at G. Abby Lee, and then mine at VOA Stevenson. Please be sure to follow our program's account as well at VOA underscore IE. There you'll get links to our podcasts and more. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. The government of Honduras has issued a state of national emergency after recording nearly 3,700 cases of the Zika virus over the previous 3 months. That follows Monday's announcement by the World Health Organization that the mosquito-borne virus is an international public health emergency linked to thousands of birth defects in Brazil. Margaret Chan, the WHO Director General, consulted with 18 advisors and experts before issuing her declaration.
The experts agree that a causal relationship between the Zika infection during pregnancy and microcephaly is strongly suspected, though not yet scientifically proven. All agree on the urgent need to coordinate international efforts to investigate and understand this relationship better. The experts also consider patterns of recent spread and the broad geographical distribution of mosquito species that can transmit the virus. the lack of vaccines and reliable diagnostic tests, and the absence of population immunity in newly affected countries were cited as further causes for concern. After a review of the evidence, the committee advised that the clusters of microcephaly and other neurological complications constitute an extraordinary event.
The WHO predicts the virus could infect as many as 4 million people in the Americas this year. The announcement comes ahead of the scheduled Summer Olympics in Brazil later this year. Sanjaya Shenaniyaka is an associate professor in medicine and an expert on infectious diseases at the Australian National University. He tells VOA's Victor Beattie this is a serious health risk on two levels.
The explosive nature of the outbreak, because as you well know, in the last year, even though it's had a very low profile for some decades, in the last year, it's managed to jump across to Central and South America, right on the doorsteps of the United States, and probably caused millions of cases. Now, that alone may not be that bad if the illness were mild, but of course, now there is strong concern. We're not 100% sure, but there's strong concern that it is responsible for a serious birth defect called microcephaly.
Is there an effective treatment for it?
No, there is none. It's a viral illness, and unlike most bacterial illnesses where you can use antibiotics, there's very limited treatment for viral infection. So there's no treatment for Zika at the moment.
How likely is this to spread beyond South America?
Well, it probably already has. It was first recognized in Uganda, the Zika forest in Uganda, where it was isolated in monkeys there. And it's been responsible for periodic small outbreaks in Africa and parts of Asia. And then in 2007, it moved to the Pacific Islands before this explosive outbreak in Central and South America. So it's already established in some parts of the world. We know that it's there in Thailand, for instance. There might be cases in Indonesia. And the main problem with it is most people who get infected with this don't get symptoms. Or if you're in the minority who do get symptoms, it's a very non-specific flu-like illness. So it is quite possible that a lot of cases of Zika in other parts of the world, such as Asia, are not being recognized or are being diagnosed as something else, such as dengue.
Are pregnant women the most at risk?
Absolutely. Most other people, non-pregnant people who get Zika, are likely not to get a sickness or get a nasty flu-like illness from which they'll recover without needing to go to hospital. But if this link is proven, and as I said, we think it's likely to be the cause, but we're not 100% sure. But yes, pregnant women are the ones at serious risk.
What does the WHO's public health emergency do for health authorities worldwide?
The public health emergency of international concern is really a ramped up public health response to what is regarded as a global emergency. And I believe this is the fourth time they've invoked that, the first time being with swine flu back in 2009, and then with Ebola and polio in Syria.
Shenaniyaka says research is already underway for a vaccine, but doesn't expect one to be available with proper testing for 1 to 2 years. French drug maker Sanofi announced Tuesday it is launching a project to develop a vaccine against the Zika virus. A UN agency says North Korea plans to launch a 4-year weather observation satellite into orbit later this month. The launch would come weeks after the reclusive state claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb. Earlier, International Edition host Michael Lippin spoke with VOA Korean Service reporter Yunjing Cho about why the United States and others are expressing concern about Pyongyang's planned satellite launch.
You know, North Korea has said that its space program is peaceful, but it is still believed to be developing an intercontinental ballistic missile that could strike not only South Korea and Japan, but also the United States. And as you know very well, that North Korea has already conducted 4 nuclear tests. So if you put a nuclear warhead on a missile and launch it to, you know, attack another country, that could be a nuclear war.
But North Korea is insisting that the purpose of this launch is to put a weather satellite into orbit. So why should we not believe them, that mm-hmm. this is purely for the purposes of weather and science?
Right. If we look at the technology, you know, it's a crossover technology. A satellite launch utilizes technology also found in ballistic missiles. And North Korea already successfully put an object into orbit in December 2012. But still, North Korea still does not have a very critical element of a ballistic missile technology, which is called a re-entry vehicle capability, which means, you know, a warhead cannot withstand the stress of an atmosphere re-entry. Even though North Korea still hasn't had this very critical technology, experts are still very cautious about North Korea's pursuit of a long-range rocket technology, because in the future, there is a possibility that North Korea can obtain this technology and successfully launch a missile.
Well, what do United Nations resolutions say about whether North Korea can engage in this kind of activity?
Well, the United Nations Security Council has banned North Korea from missile tests after its nuclear tests in 2006 and 2009 and 2012. UN resolutions prohibited North Korea from launches because, you know, as I said, the technology could be used as a dual-use applications to a ballistic missile technology. One of the resolutions in detail, if I may introduce, for instance, 1718, says that it decides the DPRK, which is North Korea, shall suspend all activities related to its ballistic missile program and, in this context, reestablish its pre-existing commitments to a moratorium on missile launching.
Well, thank you so much, Eunjung Cho of VOA's Korean service, for telling us why people are concerned about this upcoming satellite launch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as North Korea prepares for another rocket launch, reporting the news from inside that country remains a challenge for the few Western media outlets that are allowed to operate there. Chad O'Carroll is the managing editor of nknews.org. He joins us now with details on the difficulties of getting stories out of North Korea.
Reporting in North Korea is difficult. There is AP, news agency, Associated Press, and Agence France-Presse, AFP. They are also about to open up shop. However, the journalists working inside North Korea, or Western journalists working inside North Korea, have a difficult time in pursuing stories independently of North Korean state facilitation. So that means that if you wanted to do a story, for example, on human rights issues, it would be difficult to do it officially through one of those news agencies with a presence in Pyongyang. We don't have a bureau in Pyongyang, but we report through a network of sort of informants that we've managed to cultivate over the years, who are based in the sort of foreign community in Pyongyang, and also through using satellite imagery and really just following the country very closely. That kind of tacit experience of following it so closely means that we're often in a good spot to detect small changes that could be useful story leads.
Using informants, I imagine, is a bit tricky and a bit dangerous for those people.
Well, the difference between us and other websites that or news services that use informants is that all of ours are within the foreign community working in North Korea. So the dangers are less for them in sharing information than it would be for North Koreans to be sharing information with us. The other advantage of that is that these people have secure internet connections, you know, satellite internet access, so they're able to share things with us in a quite secure way, as opposed to, for example, someone who might get their hands on a foreign-capable cell phone. So, yeah, there are, of course, dangers for the people that we work with, but that, what I'm trying to convey is that it's not as much as for those sources that might be North Korean.
In working there, they often send minders around with reporters. How about moving outside of Pyongyang and into some of the other areas? What are some of the ways that they handle journalists?
Well, journalists rarely get to go to North Korea, but any journalist that is there on an official visit will always be accompanied by minders. And therefore, it's difficult to really get that much out of reporting trips. That being said, I still encourage reporters to do it because it's a great way of sometimes finding information for other stories that you might be working on or like good leads. For example, there's a lot of construction going on in Pyongyang right now. That's visible to journalists that go there. There is, you know, a very widespread use of solar panels. That's another thing that you can spot just by being there. And that's reflecting the growing power shortages within the country. I think it would be better if reporters didn't need to be minded the whole time, but it's still worth going and there's still good reporting that can be done.
NK News is available on the internet and also on Twitter, a great source of information coming out of North Korea. Chad O'Carroll is the managing editor. Chad, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, just in time for Valentine's Day, we have an adaptation of author Nicholas Sparks' 2007 novel, The Choice, and that opens February the 5th as a movie in theaters. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, this movie looks at the issues of love, loss, and hope.
Travis Parker and Gabby Holland start off as neighbors. Parker, played by Benjamin Walker, best known for Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and 2015's In the Heart of the Sea, is a laid-back, happy-go-lucky Southern charmer. He enjoys his life by the beach, being with his friends, being carefree, and especially not being tied down. That all changes when Gabby Holland moves in next door. Holland is played by Australian actress Teresa Palmer, and the heat between the two characters is instantaneous. But both are in relationships with other people. Travis with his on-again, off-again high school love, and Gabby with a successful doctor. Palmer says that the love affair, which spans a decade during the story, is about her character following her heart, even though it would mean hurting someone who loves her.
Life is just not black and white, and this movie actually helped me eradicate some of my own judgments surrounding cheating and all those sorts of things, because she truly is in a battle between her head and her heart, and she doesn't want to inflict pain on anyone or make anyone else suffer, but she has to lean in to what her heart sings, and that's being with this man. And yes, it's messy and crazy and scary and confusing, but that's life. I mean, life is full of peaks and valleys.
Benjamin Walker says that thinking that Gabby is cheating because she chooses Travis over her previous boyfriend is a silly double standard.
And it's that level of judgment that's kind of ridiculous. And I feel like if it was a man in the movie, there'd be this kind of double standard. You know, it would be understandable. And I think it's ridiculous.
Walker and Palmer both say the story deals with some tough issues that all people face. And to say that the love portrayed is based on cheating isn't being realistic.
That's how life is. And it's that level of judgment where we say this is right and this is wrong that divides us as people and as men and women and as cultural, as different cultures. And I think that's really unfair. And what's she supposed to do? Be in this relationship for the rest of her life where she's not happy?
Because of other people's standards?
Yeah, because of someone else's, what they want to label her as. I think that's ridiculous.
The crux of the story takes a dramatic twist when Gabby is in a car accident and goes into a coma. Doctors have told Travis that Gabby probably will never recover, and he has to decide whether to take her off life support or not. The Choice also stars Maggie Grace as Travis's sister Stephanie. Tom Welling stars as Dr. Ryan McCarthy, Gabby's boyfriend. Oscar nominee Tom Wilkinson stars as Dr. Shep. Author Nicholas Sparks co-wrote the screenplay with Brian Sipe. Ross Katz, who co-produced Lost in Translation with Oscar winner Sofia Coppola, directed the film. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us always at voanews.com, and we invite you to follow our Twitter stream. The handle is at @VOA_IE. We've got a lot of great people here at VOA, and I'm privileged to work with two of the best. Our engineer is Chaz Hall and director Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent trip to Cambodia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed his hope that Cambodia will realize the full benefits of a thriving multi-party democracy. He said the U.S. cares deeply about respect for human rights, universal freedoms, and good governance. And progress in each of these areas is really critical to being able to fulfill the potential of our bilateral relations, but also, importantly, the full potential of the hopes and aspirations of the Cambodian people. In his discussions with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, Secretary Kerry further stressed that democratic governments have a responsibility to ensure that all elected representatives are free to perform their responsibilities without fear of attack or arrest. This includes opposition party leader Samrong Si, who was forced into exile after the government called for his arrest for allegedly defaming Foreign Minister Hau Nam Hong. So as Cambodians prepare for elections next year, and again in 2018, it is very important to allow for vigorous but peaceful debate. The U.S. remains interested in developing its economic relations with Cambodia. Indeed, the United States is Cambodia's largest single-country export market today. Last November, both countries held their first competitiveness and growth dialogue. Now, said Secretary Kerry, we look forward to trade and investment framework agreement talks that will take place soon, and we will continue to explore ways to deepen our trade and investment relationships, including by helping to tackle corruption and exploring ways to strengthen Cambodia's legal institutions. To that end, the United States looks forward to welcoming Cambodia to the U.S.-ASEAN summit in February. A thread of common concern to both the U.S. and Cambodia is countering violent extremism. Prime Minister Hun Sen expressed interest in Cambodia working with the U.S.-led coalition against Daesh. The U.S. also cooperates with Cambodia on other issues, including health and food security and mine clearance. There are active Fulbright and Peace Corps programs on the ground in Cambodia, and the U.S. continues to help with sustainable development in the Mekong River region. The U.S. remains deeply committed to its partnership with Cambodia and with all the members of ASEAN on a regional and global basis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.